In 1981 I made a short summary of the inner earth theme in relation to ufology and esotericism, published in the FOO newsletter, The Inner Earth Theory, a Source Study, a FOO newsletter, number 22, August, December 1981. At that time very few ufologists were interested in these ideas, but today there is a plethora of more or less fantastic conspiracy theories and claims of inner earth contacts, especially from various channelers. For a serious ufologist or esotericist to separate the wheat from the chaff in this underground jungle of conflicting information is an undertaking worthy of a Sisyphos. An agnostic or interesting, if true, attitude is the best option when dealing with these controversial ideas and experiences. In this blog, I present some of the data from my files that I personally find interesting. Who are these people? Was the question I posed in a former blog entry, referring to contact experiences with aliens who look like us and mingle in our society. In their discussion of theories in the edge of reality, Alan Hayek and Jacques Vallée used the term Earth-bound aliens for this group of visitors. McDonough's called them crypto-terrestrials in his book, published in 2010. A group of people with an advanced technology, sharing our planet but who have kept themselves hidden and unknown for various reasons. According to some contactees and esotericists, they have developed an advanced civilization in large caverns, deep inside the interior of the Earth, and this is their secret of the ages. The first pre-Adamski contactee, Eugene H. Drake, 1889-1973, mentioned this civilization in his first book Visitors from Space, 1950. There is an ancient civilization living underground with entrances in Mexico, and not such a great distance from Mexico City. They often come to the surface and mingle with the people, but aside from a few mystics, the people of Mexico do not know this, and they would have a difficult time, if they did, to locate the entrances to their underground cities. P. 26. There is also a very cryptic statement in Howard Menger's book From Outer Space to You, when discussing a conspiracy of others operating on our planet, a spacewoman relates to Menger. They use people not only from this planet, but also other people of your own planet, people you don't know about, people who live unobserved and undiscovered as yet. It is a kind of underground, in your popular terminology. 144. In 2015 I asked my American contactee friend about these claims. He divulged some rather startling experiences. At first, there were the people, who since ancient times, have lived inside our planet. I have met some of them, fine people. Hakan, do the people living inside our planet have sources? Do they look like us? X, yes. They have craft. Yes. They look like you and me, although they have other sizes among them because of the gravity variations over the centuries, I would assume. Hakan, how do you know which people are from inside the Earth and which are the friends upstairs? X, friends upstairs are light beings. They have 100% control over light, people inside our Earth, just human. The types of craft, the methods of travel and communicating, all telling signs. Friends upstairs can go invisible at the snap of a finger, walk through walls, levitate by thought travel. Very little is said about the inner earth in the esoteric tradition, although a few hints are given by some authors. The reason for this scarcity of information is also in esotericism ascribed to the extreme secrecy of the subject. It is truly regarded as the secret of the ages. This was explained by Theosophist Charles Leadbeater in the 1895 classic The Astral Plane. There are two other great evolutions which at present share the use of this planet with humanity, but about them it is forbidden to give any particulars at this stage of the proceedings. P. 91, but he did give a few hints in a later work, The Inner Life I, originally published in 1910. The conditions of the interior of our Earth are not easy to describe. Vast cavities exist in it, and there are races inhabiting these cavities, but they are not of the same evolution as ourselves. One of these evolutions is at the level distinctly lower than any race now existing upon the surface of the Earth, The other is more nearly at our level, yet utterly different from anything that we know. Mead Lane, founder of Borderland Sciences Research Associates BSRA, had a deep fascination with the Inner Earth Enigma. He had a conversation on this issue with one of the Inner Circle members on November 22, 1947. Medium Mark Probert hearing the answers clairaudiently and relaying them to Mead. Yes, indeed, there are vast underground regions, caverns, that stretch from equatorial Africa to the North Pole, and also to Venezuela, where there is an opening. The opening in Venezuela is in the southern tip, in the region north of Loreto, Q. Of size of underground population, I would say several millions. Oh, yes, they are humans. Yes, there is some contact, but mainly through their secret organizations. These people as a whole are much more healthy than those of the surfaces. Yes, in some parts of the underground world people possess a high degree of culture. Yes, there are openings in Mexico, and one in the region of Alberta, Canada. Those underground regions, Round Robin, Volume 18, Number 2, March 1962, 17. Irene and Mark Probert. In 1871, one of the most famous classics in esoteric literature was published, The Coming Race, by Edward Bulwer Lytton. He was a member of the Real and Secret Rosicrucian Order and obviously decided to disclose their secret of the ages, but using a fictional form. I am somewhat surprised that, to my knowledge, no ufologists nor esotericists have noticed the close resemblance between the people described in The Coming Race and some contactee experiences. It is even mentioned that the inhabitants of the Inner Earth travel in air boats. P. 56. All quotes are from the edition published by Wesleyan University Press, 2005. Ufologists who have made an in-depth study of contactee cases will surely associate these quotes with various observations made in another context. It was the face of a man, but yet of a type of man distinct from our known extant races. Its color was peculiar, more like that of the red man than any other variety of our species, and yet different from it, a richer and softer hue, with large black eyes, deep and brilliant. The face was beardless, they seemed as void of the lines and shadows which care and sorrow, and passion and sin, leave upon the faces of men, as are the faces of sculptured gods. I never met one person deformed or misshapen. The beauty of their countenances is not only in symmetry of feature, but in the smoothness of surface, which continues without line or wrinkle to the extreme of old age. A figure, in a simpler garb than that of my guide, but of similar fashion, was standing motionless near the threshold. My guide touched it twice with his staff, and it put itself into a rapid and gliding movement, skimming noiselessly over the floor. Gazing on it, I then saw that it was no living form, but a mechanical automaton, four automata, mechanical contrivances which, with these people, answer the ordinary purposes of domestic service, stood phantom, like at each angle in the wall. 13, 19. These subterranean philosophers assert that, by one operation of will, they can influence the variations of temperature, that by other operations, akin to those ascribed to mesmerism, electro, biology, odic force but applied scientifically through vril conductors, they can exercise influence over minds and bodies animal and vegetable, to an extent not surpassed in the romances of our mystics. To all such agencies they give the common name of vril. P. 27. These are only a few of the quotes in the novel, but ufologists and esotericists can find many more that give very clear associations to the contactee cases of our time. Probing into these areas can of course be somewhat mind-shattering and unnerving. Suppose you really find out that there is a secret war going on this planet, a power struggle between secret groups of various motives cooperating with, or manipulating, hitherto unknown intelligences, and that the UFO phenomenon is only the tip of the iceberg of this cosmic Watergate. A phenomenon cleverly used by both the Alpha and Omega groups. Few ufologists, not to mention the public, could take such a revelation without developing at least a mild form of paranoia. How about stamp collecting? a unique document. Any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic. This classic quote from science fiction author Arthur C. Clarke often comes to my mind when studying and documenting UFO close encounter experiences. There are literally thousands of cases where the percipient relates that the UFO or alien beings simply disappeared into thin air. A good example is the observation in Sweden 1970 by witnesses Rolf Goss and Peter Ingemark, who were very perplexed that the craft they observed suddenly disappeared, like you switch off a lamp. The object that suddenly disappeared before Goss and Ingemark. That an advanced civilization can use several means to affect this phenomenon was reported by many of the first generation physical contactees in the 1950s. It could be done by a small technical device, ordinary materialization or holographic technology. George Van Tassel mentioned several of these experiences in his books and newsletter proceedings. By referring to early contactees like George Van Tassel, I am expressing somewhat heretical views in mainstream ufology. So as not to confuse new blog readers, below is a short summary of the esoteric intervention theory I have advanced in books, articles and blog entries. Some of the physical contactees of the 1950s were involved in a cultural and psychological influence test. An experiment implemented by a group of benevolent alien visitors, Earth-based or extraterrestrial, a group with access to the MANA technology. This test was done in cooperation with the Higher Intelligence Agency, HIA, the custodians of the ancient wisdom, using a new type of phenomena as attraction as they used spiritualist phenomena in connection with the founding of the Theosophical Society in 1875. Involved in this test was A.O. George Adamski, Orfeo Angelasi, Paul M. Vest, George Van Tassel, Daniel Fry and Howard Menger. During my many years of investigation and documentation of physical contactee cases, I have found enough circumstantial empirical evidence to accept some of the 1950s contact experiences as valid and worthy of further study and analysis. Scientific ufology usually regard this group of contactees as charlatans and imposters, but I am too old to play the ufologically correct game, so instead I adhere to the motto of my old mentor, the late Riley Grab, for many years director of Borderland Sciences Research Foundation, BSRA: if I have one goal in life, it is an uncompromising search for truth, whatever that might be, and wherever it may lead. There is still very little research accomplished nor understanding of what really happened during the first UFO era of the 1950s. Many silent contactees stayed silent and worked behind the scenes. This was mentioned by Rosemary M. Decker in her book 35 Minutes to Mars, published by Golder Press, 2004. She became involved with several of the contactees of that time. In the chapter Reminiscences of George Adamski and Company, she has this to say anent this era: sometimes, guests would report their own close encounters. Very few of them ever publicized their contacts. And so I learned early on that the vast majority of early contacts were never made public, even as today's are not. Some of these people found ways to express appreciation and do something to benefit our troubled planet. This quiet, but profound, movement is still going on, not only among those pioneers who still remain with us, but among close, encountered people today. 179. In February 2015, I received a very unusual and fascinating document from an American friend, working behind the scenes with the same group of benevolent visitors who contacted A.O. George Adamski, George Van Tassel, Paul M. Vest and Howard Menger. It was 3 pages written on an old-style typewriter. The headline said, "Impressions of C.R. Our time, 1 p.m., July 10, 1953 concerning John Doe Wheeler. I have not been able to find out who C.R. is, but presumable he or she was a theosophist in the California area, because of information in the last sentence. My first thought was that it could have been journalist Manon Darlene, who was very well informed about the California ufological underground scene in the 1950s, but I don't know if she was a theosophist. The papers give a lot of data on one of the visitors, known as Mr. Wheeler, also described by George Van Tassel, Paul M. Vest, and Howard Menger. Paul M. Vestin involved in the controversial Los Angeles Times affair with journalist Morris Beam. Especially it addressed the controversial issue of organic versus non-organic beings. Regarding Wheeler's physical body, it is stated that it is composed of a substance between protoplasm and a moderately stiff jelly. This person may be defined as android electric energy or android energy, that is, true absolute energy in the semblance of a human form. Now compare this to the description of Mr. Wheeler, named Bill in his article, given by journalist Paul M. Vest. I recalled how odd his hand had felt in my grasp. Looking at his hands, I noticed that his fingers were long and tapering and so smooth that they seemed to be without joints or underlying bone structure. From an esoteric viewpoint, this comment is significant. This person, at the moment, represents the level to which Homo sapiens may evolve after the passage of the next 1,000 years of our present progressively intensifying rate of evolution. As to Wheeler's purpose here, to link Earth with the planetary communication system. In his book Venus Rising, author Raymond Andrew Keller II, documents an interesting conversation in the spring of 1992 with ufologist and contactee Gabriel Green regarding bodies found in crashed saucers. There were several remarkable differences, but not so outwardly noticeable. First, they didn't have the spiral DNA strand found in nearly all indigenous life forms on Earth. Their cells were actually composed of latticed crystalline hexagonal structures, similar in composition to the walls of their scout craft. It's almost as though they were artificially constructed beings, designed to easily disassemble or reassemble. But their cells were silicon-based, rather than carbon-based. 172. A very similar description of space beings is given by the remarkable deep trance medium Mark Probert. The blood nature of these beings is this: carbon, silicon, and hydrogen. Especially is this true when they take on form so as to be seen by your eyes. Silicon and carbon makes for strength, as in the case of diamonds, which do not deteriorate except under great heat. This makes these beings very durable. It is likely that in taking form such bodies could suffer such injury as to produce seeming death, but the entity concerned would simply withdraw and reconstruct its vehicle when and where desired. My American friend who forwarded the Wheeler papers told me of his first experience of the visitors dissolving and forming their bodies, something described by many contactees. Before I had my first visits, I was a total unbelieving skeptic. And I said to them at one point, "Give me proof, personally, and I need never ask that again, that's for sure. When you get proof, my friend, you will feel like the world as you knew it has ended." I remember the first time there was about 5 space people in 20, name withheld, house talking with her as I quietly watched, and then suddenly one of the men turned, looked directly at me, smiled gently, and then very slowly turned to the kitchen room wall and walked right through the wall. I watched this very closely as he then came back in. Let me tell you, those kind of incidents have a very deep and troubling effect on our minds because we cannot comprehend it. Mail conversation February 25, 26, 2012. Robert Heinlein and Esotericism. The novel, Lost Legacy, by science fiction writer Robert A. Heinlein, 1907-1988, has been one of my absolute favorite novels since I first read it many years ago. It was originally published in the November 1941 issue of Super Science Stories and later included in the collection Assignment in Eternity. I know of few novels that reveal such a deep and innate understanding of esoteric philosophy. An accomplished and erudite esotericist could hardly have done a better job. This novel is must reading for anyone seriously interested in the esoteric tradition. The narrative centers around a trio from a California university: Dr. Philip Huxley, professor of psychology; Dr. Ben Coburn, neurosurgeon; and Joan Freeman, student of psychology. They discover psychic abilities in one another and theorize that all humans possess these faculties as potentialities. When their superiors at the university become aware of their heretic interest and activities, they are immediately discouraged from pursuing such research. Drive Huxley laments the situation: fat chance. I talked with the dean and he wouldn't even take it up with the president. Scared that the old fathead will clamp down on the department even more than he has. You see, officially, we are supposed to be behavior might be something to consciousness that can't be explained in terms of physiology and mechanics is about as welcome as a Saint Bernard in a telephone booth. Dr. Huxley has been collecting data on all sorts of paranormal phenomena that run contrary to orthodox psychological theory. I decided to forget about theories, to treat these outcast phenomena like any ordinary data, and see where it landed me. Very little of it has been duplicated in the Western Hemisphere, which counts against it, nevertheless a lot of odd stuff. In India has been reported by competent cool-minded observers, telepathy, accurate soothsaying, clairvoyance, firewalking and so forth. This trio of heretic academics decides on a road trip to Mount Shasta. Climbing the mountain, Ben Coburn falls on a slippery cliff and receives a fracture of the shin bone. A tall, elderly man appears from nowhere and offers his help. The group are led through a passageway into the mountain where they find themselves in a living room, illuminated by indirect lightning. They spend the night in this room and in the morning Ben's wound has mysteriously and completely healed. They are then introduced to the around 30 persons resident in several rooms, men and women of different ages and nationalities. Questioned how this community could exist without it being a matter of common knowledge, the group is informed that, "We have taken certain precautions, to avoid notoriety. Our reasons, and the precautions they inspire will become evident to you." Philip, Ben and Joan are then briefed on the history of the community, their philosophy, inner powers and work in the world. They are custodians of the ancient wisdom and have for ages worked behind the scenes to further the cultural and spiritual evolution of man on planet Earth. There are so many well-formulated esoteric statements in Lost Legacy that I have often wondered whether Robert Heinlein was a student of the esoteric tradition. I have found no definite information on this issue, but his second wife, Leslyn MacDonald, who held a master's degree in philosophy, was said to have practiced white witchcraft. And her mother was a theosophist. There is also indications that Heinlein was influenced by Gurdjieff's disciple P.D. Ouspensky. Here a few quotes from Lost Legacy with comments. "We see the history of the world as a series of crises in a conflict between two opposing philosophies. Ours is based on the notion that life, consciousness, intelligence, ego is the important thing in the world." P. 64, Paperback Ed. 1978. This is the quintessence or central idea in esoteric philosophy, the science of the multiverse. Human self, consciousness, the illuminated window in the cosmic night, is to me a tremendous mystery. Simply defining man in material terms is presenting an incongruous flatland model of something infinitely greater. There is a quality in human self, consciousness that requires a different approach. I can never accept the proposition that a lump of matter randomly can form sentient beings, conscious, self, reflecting and capable of ethical decisions. That human beings have an almost unlimited capacity for evil, is something that we are constantly reminded of by reading global media. But what is really interesting and hopeful is that we can surmount harsh existential conditions and develop an almost limitless kindness and empathy. Here we find an indication that the deeper meaning of our existence is the transformation and evolution of our consciousness. We are a step in the evolution of consciousness in the multiverse. This basic idea is summarized by the Swedish esotericist Henry T. Lawrence in Knowledge of Life 2, "What is lacking in all religions is the knowledge of the meaning of life." Consciousness development. Christianity knows of nothing but eternal bliss in heaven. The yoga philosophy thinks that evolution has reached its final goal with man and what remains for man is to become God, to enter the absolute. It knows nothing of higher kingdoms, that man's next goal is to attain the fifth natural kingdom. Free will is the primary good of the cosmos. P. 58, the most important law of life in esotericism is the law of freedom. In all ages and nations, humans constantly strive for freedom from religious and economic oppression, war, totalitarian rule. Henry T. Lawrence devotes a chapter to a detailed exposition of this law in his book The Philosopher's Stone, Divine Right is Individual Sovereignty. Man is a potential godhead. No power has any right to take away the freedom that life grants to the individual. The individual has an inalienable, divine right to think, feel, say, and do whatever pleases him, as long as, in so doing, he does not violate the right of anybody else, does not infringe the equal right of all to that same inviolable freedom. The forces that killed enlightenment in the rest of the world are spreading here. Little by little they have whittled away human liberty and human dignity. A repressive law. A blind dogma, to be accepted under pain of prosecution. You see, sir, our antagonists don't wait. They are active all the time. They've won our Asia, they are in the ascendancy in Europe, they may win here in America. With the aid of the archives they, Philip, Ben, Joan, learned the technique spite which the Brotherhood of Adepts had interceded in the past when freedom of thought and action in America had been threatened. In Lost Legacy, Robert Heinlein makes it very clear that Orthodox religion is, and have been, one of the largest impediments to human progress and happiness. The perfect tool for the forces of darkness. In earlier centuries, Christianity represented oppression, but today it has been moderated by the ideas of the Enlightenment, humanism, science, and the modern project. Freedom and democracy are today instead threatened by global Islamic fundamentalism. Islam as a world religion has not passed through the evolutionary stages and philosophical moderation as Christianity, and because of this stagnation represent a grave danger to the free world. The custodians of the ancient wisdom have many times pointed out this problem to humanity. In the classic The Mahatma Letters to A.P. Sinnett, the adept K.H. give this view on the history of religion. The chief cause of nearly two-thirds of the evils that pursue humanity ever since that cause became a power. It is religion under whatever form and in whatever nation. It is the sacerdotal caste, the priesthood and the churches. It is in those illusions that man looks upon as sacred, that he has to search out the source of that multitude of evils which is the great curse of humanity and that almost overwhelms mankind. It is belief in God and gods that makes two-thirds of humanity the slaves of a handful of those who deceive them under the false pretense of saving them. Interestingly, we find the same information coming from some of the first generation UFO contactees. Howard Menger was warned by his Venusian contacts about the opposition to their work. "My friend, this earth is the battlefield of Armageddon, and the battle is for men's minds and souls. You don't know, Howard, that there is a very powerful group on this planet. This group has been infiltrating religious organizations to dupe your peoples into a distorted concept of truth which enveloped your planet thousands of years ago. They are using the credulity and simple faith of many people to attain their own ends." Howard Menger, From Outer Space to You, 1959. Even the controversial UFO contactee George Adamski presented a similar view in his last book, Flying Saucers Farewell. Addressing the community of priests in a fictional form, he writes, "You no doubt consider yourself a true prophet, a messenger of God, but even you, you and thousands of other appointed ministers and teachers of truth are actually messengers of Satan. You have perverted the laws of the cosmos even as the so-called criminal element of the world has done. It was religion that withheld the right of free thought, crying heresy to the works of scientific minds such as Copernicus, Galileo, Kepler and hundreds of others. Religion as it has been taught and practiced stands only as a symbol of oppression." The similarities in message and philosophy in the esoteric tradition and from some of the UFO contactees is very detailed, as I have been trying to demonstrate in this blog and other writings. It is therefore reasonable to assume a common source or purpose. Hence the esoteric intervention theory. Heinlein's Lost Legacy is a treasure trove of esoteric philosophy. An excellent choice for summer reading. And of this extract from this book of Håkan Blomqvist, Esotericism and UFO Research, which was here made as audiobook, because I prefer to listen to such kind of information, rather than meaningless radio, which has now also fallen out in my part of Norway, when the public broadcasting, NRK, has now switched to sending only on DAB. No loss, when I have such self-produced audiobooks, which I can also share with other interested, here. Final comment of Rune. The book lacked the esoteric illumination of this theme from the Tibetan Lobsang Rampa.